somebody gave me some rolls of stuff before, so if you're interested, I can see what I got.
I never had used that stuff. When I was building, it was still expanding.
Yeah, I know, that's the way I did too. But it's really, once you get used to it, it really works well.
Doesn't it?
If you have an iron to use,
my brother does.
Okay.
Iron roller.
Yeah. Oh, okay, fine. And you're all set. Even I did it with a regular, my wife's iron for a long time when I got one of those little ones.
Really?
And it works real slick. You just got to get the temperature right. And,
you can take warps out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
you'll be amazed once you get it. Take a little while to get used to it after doing stove and cooking. After a while, you'll probably be converted.
One thing is,
when you have a crash, you know, you have a bag of, because the stuff doesn't penetrate like that.
The other thing that's really strange now is using the green thing, hot stuff,
yeah,
super jet,
sure,
and all that.
Oh, I know.
Like,
all the
ones. I did it all custom, put it there. Uh oh.
Yeah.
It doesn't move.
Yeah, it's a whole different ballgame now.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, ready to resume here. Chapter 45. Joseph had just made an invitation, as it were, to his father to come back and the whole family to dwell in Egypt. And this was also by design. Remember that God had told Abraham long before that his posterity was going to go through a long time of darkness, as it were, a time of bondage for 400 years. And so God is setting the stage for that. And at first, it's not a time of bondage, of course. It's a time of blessing, or at least a time of taking refuge to survive. But, of course, this is going to set the stage for the beginning of the book of Exodus when conditions change. Now, verses 11 to 16, we'll resume here. Verse 11, "And there I will nourish thee, for yet there are 5 years of famine, lest thou and thy household and all that thou hast come to poverty. Behold, your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin, that it is my mouth that speaketh unto you. And ye shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt, and all that ye have seen, and ye shall haste and bring down my father hither. And he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brethren and wept upon them, and after that his brethren talked with him. Verse 16, "And the fame thereof was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, Joseph's brethren are come, and it pleased Pharaoh well and his servants." Now obviously the nature of this Pharaoh's heart was quite a bit different than ones that were going to come. But this pleased Pharaoh, God, and in typology, in a certain restricted typological sense, he's representing God here, and God is giving favor to Israel in the eyes of Egypt here. And so for a season here, Israel is going to be in a very favored position. Verses 17 to 19 then, "And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, Say unto thy brethren, This do ye, lay your beasts, and go get you into the land of Canaan. And take your father and your households, and come unto me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt, and ye shall eat the fat of the land. And now thou art commanded, this do ye, take you wagons out of the land of Egypt for your little ones and your wives, and bring your father and come." So he's commanded. Now, Pharaoh is commanding Joseph to let his brothers take wagons from Egypt, probably because he loved and trusted Joseph. And Pharaoh, it was pleasing in the eyes of Pharaoh, and so he's just, he's saying, he's commanding this just to make sure that Joseph will do it. And it's really an outstanding favor to Joseph. And he shows him a favor, and to show him the favor, he commands him in this, though he usually didn't command him. He usually just left everything in Joseph's hand. But this is kind of a loving command, I'm going to require you to do this thing that you want to do, It's kind of a nice kind of command. So they obviously had a very good relationship. All right? And they're supplying wagons and supplying things so that they can bring his family up with ease. Verse 20, "Also regard not your stuff, for the good of all the land of Egypt is yours." Now, the point is, don't worry about bringing back into Egypt all your furnishings, your stuff, as it were, all your belongings and possessions and furnishings. That would require a lot more moving and so forth. He said, just leave them, and we'll provide better ones. In other words, he's offering them to provide them for all that they need. Okay, verse 21 and 22. "And all the children of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the commandments of Pharaoh, and gave them provision for the way. To all of them he gave each man the changes of raiment, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of raiment." Okay? Still showing favor to Benjamin. Now, changes of raiment were something that was very, very, to us, you know, giving us a change of clothes is kind of nice, but it's not, you know, we get really thrilled or excited about it. But to them, clothing was a very, very highly prized thing, and it was really a man's most important possession. And so to give him changes of raiment, to give him more clothes, was really an outstanding kindness. And it's interesting here in type as well. Christ changes our raiment to robes of righteousness. He gives us new clothes when we come to him and we get established in his kingdom. And gifts of clothing were a very special favor in the East at that time. Benjamin receives 300 pieces of silver. That's the price of 10 slaves. And 5 changes of raiment. Again, 5 representing the number of grace, unmerited favor. And again, it's because of love. Why did he do it? Because he loved him so much. Just because he loved him, he gave it to him. Okay, and verse 23 and 24. And to his father he sent after this manner, 10 asses laden with good things of Egypt, 10 she-asses laden with corn and bread and meat for his father by the way. So he sent his brethren away, and they departed. And he said unto them, see that ye fall not out by the way. Now this phrase, fall not out by the way, is better translated quarrel or have an argument. In other words, see that you don't have an argument by the way. In other words, he's probably concerned that they might argue over who was most guilty in selling Joseph, or over why Benjamin got more blessing or whatever, you know. So he just reminds them, now that he's taken them through this, they're probably going to do anything he says. And so he says, don't you argue on the way. He wants their whole nature and everything changed as a result of all of this. And it's like the Lord saying to his church, you know, you're on this journey from here to glory. I don't want you arguing and fighting with one another on the way and worried about who's going to get the most favored position in the kingdom and why God blessed this person and didn't bless the other one and why John gets to stay and see the end of the coming and the others are going to die and so forth. He says, don't be quarreling in the way. Okay, verse 25 to 28 to finish this chapter. And they went up out of Egypt and came into the land of Canaan unto Jacob their father and told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted, for he believed them not. So for him now, this is over 20 years that he's lost his son. He can hardly believe what he's hearing. Verse 27, and they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said unto them. And when he saw the wagons which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. And Israel said, it is enough. Joseph my son is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. So he was convinced then that this was true. He saw the wagons, saw all the provisions from Egypt, knew they couldn't have come up with this any other way. Now, it was almost too good to be true for Jacob. He receives Joseph from the dead in type, as it were, because in his heart he had died, and now he's seeing him just as if he'd been resurrected. Several types here to comment on before we move on. Joseph kissed his repentant brethren, just as God did to the prodigal son. Those that had turned and squandered their way, as it were, have come and repented, are kissed and loved. Joseph rejoices over his wayward brethren's return, as God does and the angels. The scripture says all the angels of heaven rejoice over one lost sinner that returns. Joseph commissions his brethren to go and bring others, namely his father and their wives and their children, to him to be saved, as it were, and to be saved from the famine. And so now that his brethren have accepted him, he commissions them and he says, go and bring the others here as well. And so Christ is telling us as well, go into all the nations, preach the gospel, bring redemption, you see, bring them unto Christ so that they can be saved. And he says, make haste, because the time is short, because the famine is on. It's still going to be 5 years of famine. They need to be saved before any of them die of starvation. And he exhorts them, Joseph exhorts them as they go, not to strive with one another. 2 Timothy 2:24, alluded to this before, but here's a reference on that. 2 Timothy 2:24, the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be patient toward all men. And Joseph was at first despised by his brethren, but now they go to spread his message. Now they're going to say that Joseph is alive. So they're not jealous of Joseph anymore. We're not going to be jealous of Jesus. We're not going to be jealous that, why did he get to have all that blessing? I mean, he was a man like we are, and he gets all this honor and glory and be put in the number one position, and we have to bow down to him. And we're not going to feel that way. I hope none of you feel that way now. It's inconceivable to me that anybody should feel that way. But some people wonder, well, why did Jesus get an unfair advantage over us in that he was born of a virgin and wasn't born with the same tendency towards sin that we have? And my first response is, why are we complaining? Why are we complaining? If that were not so, we wouldn't have redemption. We wouldn't have eternal life. Just be thankful for the grace of God. Be thankful that God did this. But remember that even though Jesus may have had a certain advantage in that God circumvented some problems because of the due to the curse through the virgin birth. You have to remember that he also was tempted in all points like as we, but even more so in some respects, the devil came to him personally. He was tempted in areas that we wouldn't be tempted. We're not tempted to turn a stone into a piece of bread. We're not tempted to jump down from the pinnacle of the temple like he was. We're not facing the same kind of degree of thing that he faced. And God is just in all things. Jesus was facing something very similar to what Adam faced, who also did not have any tendency towards sin when the devil tempted him. Okay, Genesis 46 then. And Israel took his journey with all that he had, and came to Beersheba, and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. So he's moving now toward Egypt, and it's a very big step to move this small nation from the land that God had promised them into Egypt. This is not an easy thing. Jacob stops in Beersheba, the well of the oath, as we've seen before, to consult God and to offer sacrifices. He probably had some doubts in his mind. First of all, God hadn't spoken about this to him yet. God hadn't come and revealed himself to him and said, Jacob, go to Egypt and to join yourself to your son. He hadn't got a direct word from God. God had promised them the land of Canaan. And so it would be a problem in leaving the land of Canaan to go to Egypt, even if it was intended only to be temporary. He remembered that Abraham went to Egypt because of famine, and he fell into sin and trouble as a result of it, almost lost his wife. And Isaac was told not to go down to Egypt in famine because of the same problem. So his father was told not to go down, and I'm sure he'd heard that story. So there were probably some things going on in his mind, some wondering, consternation about this. But this time God has prepared the way and put his own man in authority and has a purpose in view to multiply the nation. So this thing was really ordained of God. And so apparently he satisfies himself of that. But he wants to give God an opportunity to give him any correction along the way here. Verses 2 to 4. And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night, and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again. And Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. So God is giving him unmistakable assurance that this is all right, that this is of God, and it was, of course, a very difficult thing for him to leave the land of promise. But God had designs to make a nation in a protected environment, even though it was going to be a rather hostile environment by the time it was all through. God was going to make a nation within a nation, and the time was going to come when Egypt was going to have to give birth to Israel, and they were going to leave. And so he says that God told him that I'm going to bring thee up again. Now, Jacob probably thought this meant within a few years, because in his own mind, the famine was said to be only 5 more years and so forth. He was probably thinking in terms of years. But Israel was going to be suffering in Egypt for a long time. And to prepare them, and possibly because of their own sin in selling Joseph and so forth and having pride, they were going to need to, just as the original brethren did, come to a place of humility, come to a place of brokenness. You know, we might wonder, why did God leave them for 400 years in that land and not just take them out earlier? But God sees things that we don't see. He sees reasons that we don't always see. And they certainly came to a certain point. There was enough trouble when they did finally come out. There was enough murmuring and saying, go back into Egypt. I mean, if they'd only been there for a few years or a few generations, they probably never would have left. Or if they had left, they'd have hightailed it back to Egypt right away. There was already a tendency for them to do that. So there are lots of things that God has in mind. He says to Jacob also that Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. The idea there is to close your eyes in death. In other words, it's a word of comfort. In a sense, Joseph's going to be with you on the day of your death is what he's telling him. And Joseph, your closest relative, and that was the duty of the closest relative, to close the eyes of the person after they died. And this is a promise that he was giving him. Joseph, you're going to stay there in Egypt until your death, and Joseph is going to be with you, your beloved son, and he's going to close your eyes on the day of your death. Now, Jacob was now 130 years old at this time, and he was going to live 17 more years in Egypt. So he would die at the age of 147. Genesis 47:28 is a reference to that. Genesis 47, verse 28. As I said, it was the duty of the closest relative, in this case Joseph, because he was the firstborn son of that beloved wife, to close the eyes after death. Now, Jacob as a man would not come out of Egypt, except his bones would come out, but the nation would. And so he says, you're going to come out, but he's talking about the nation, not about Joseph as a man. So here Jacob is pointing to the man, and Israel is pointing to the nation. And so he's talking about Israel coming out, as it were, and that's the nation, but Jacob as a man is not going to. So we see some distinction here. Now, later on, we've seen kind of an interplay back and forth between Jacob and Israel here, and there hasn't been a huge distinction between the two, except maybe this, in some passages, the distinction between the nation and the individual. But later on in the narrative, and it's already begun to some extent, you're going to see that the term Jacob is used when Israel is referred to in their backslidden state or in a cantankerous state or unwillingness or rebellion or whatever, whereas the term Israel is going to be chosen very often when there's a contrast being made, when it's speaking of the more spiritual aspects, the ones as they're prevailing with God, as they're believing and so forth. Now, that's not going to be an ironclad rule, because there will be times when there'll be a distinction between Judah and Israel and the northern tribes and so forth, and you've got quite a different situation there. But keep that in mind. One example of what I said here is in Genesis 45, just the previous chapter, and verses 26 and 28. In 26 we read, and told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he has governed all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted, for he believed them not. So the term Jacob is used there when it says he believed them not. Down in verse 28, and Israel said, it is enough, Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go down and see before I die. When he's believing, he's called Israel. When he's unbelieving, he's called Jacob. So that's kind of an interesting example of that. And so be watching for that. That'll come up from time to time. But it's not an ironclad rule. Sometimes the terms are pretty much interchangeable. But in the prophets especially, where you're really dealing with the character of the nation, there's quite a distinction there. Okay, verses 5 and 6. And Jacob arose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle and their goods, which they had gotten in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him. The goods here refers to their personal property and valuables. It's not referring to all their furnishings and so forth, which they were told to leave, but the real important personal belongings and that sort of thing is what's being spoken of. Verses 7 and 8, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his seed brought he with him into Egypt. And these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt, Jacob and his sons, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, the sons of Reuben, and so forth. Now, we won't read through all of these, but it's a list of the genealogy, as it were, a list of all the sons and the sons' sons and so forth that came in to Egypt with them. And so rather than go through this all, we'll move down to verse 26 and 27, which kind of summarizes this. All the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins, besides Jacob's sons' wives, all the souls were 66. So a score is 20, 60 is 60, and so there's 66 souls that come down. And that's not counting Jacob's sons' wives, but all that came out of his loins. In other words, all the seed, the grandsons, and so forth, but not counting the wives. Now, if you add to that Jacob himself, Joseph, and Joseph's two sons who were already in Egypt, you get a total of 70 if you add those others in. And so that would be the total ones of Israel that are in Egypt. Exodus 1:5 is the reason I make that addition, because Exodus chapter 1, verse 5 refers to 70. And so if you have the 66 here, plus Jacob himself, plus Joseph and Joseph's two sons who are in Egypt, that gives you a total of 70. Now in Acts 7:14, in the New Testament, we read that 75 souls in all went down. So we've got a different number there. And this is in the instance where I think it's Stephen giving this account. And in chapter 7, verse 14, I'll just read it. And then sent Joseph and called his father Jacob to him, all his kindred, 65 souls. So 65 is 75. So the question is, this is one of those things where the liberals come and say, see, there's contradictions in the Bible. That one said 75, that one said 66, so the Bible's obviously mistaken. Well, there's a number of possibilities. First of all, this number in Acts 7:14 may include, like the Septuagint does, the five sons and grandsons of Ephraim and Manasseh. So Ephraim and Manasseh had five sons and grandsons, and so they may be included here, and that would give you a total of 75 if you had the original 70. Or they may possibly be speaking only of those who came into Egypt at this time and include the wives. In other words, rather than He's talking in Acts 7:14. He's talking about the ones who came down to Egypt. So that might not include Joseph and his sons who were already in Egypt. And the ones who came down to Egypt were these 66 plus the wives. The wives certainly came with them. They leave the wives behind. But they weren't counted because they weren't part of the seed. So if you add the wives, if there were just nine wives, that would make it 75. Now, you might ask, well, why nine wives? If there were 11 sons, why not have 11 wives? First of all, Judah's wife was dead. We read about that in Genesis 38:12. So Judah's wife was dead, and Benjamin was unmarried. He was still too young, or at least was not married. And Joseph was already in Egypt, so all you would need to have is nine wives. So that's another way to resolve the problem. So actually, the number of souls that came down would have been 75, if you count the 66 plus the nine wives. So it's just a matter of which way they're numbering, which way they're reckoning things. And to glibly assert there's a contradiction is just, usually a person has not got enough integrity to begin to look more deeply. Anybody who reads history books, if you've ever tried to do any kind of a report or give a synopsis or of a certain portion of history and done some research on that period, to try, even if you're within one history book, you'll find all kinds of dates that seem to contradict themselves. And they'll say in such and such a date this happened, and another passage will say a different date for the same thing. And usually you'll find out that one is giving the time that the event started, and the other one's giving the time that it finished, or one's just giving an approximate time, for the whole thing. All kinds of things like that happen, and we accept that for normal history books, but people just seem to have a problem when it comes to the Bible. Of course, the real problem is that they're hostile to it, and they're trying to find anything that they can to try to find a contradiction or generate one. Yes, Rob? Judah's wife was dead. Genesis 38:12 is a reference here. Let's check it to make sure I got the right reference, in case there's any problem. Okay, yes. In the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shears, Timnath, and so forth, his friend Herod the Adullamite. Okay, so Judah's wife, who was the daughter of Shua, died. So now, of course, we're not told whether he remarried or anything, but, in other words, it does state that she died, and this is a very good possibility. Yes, Mike? Okay, the 66 to 70 would be, in Exodus 1:5, let's just maybe take a quick look at that just to see what that verse says. Exodus 1:5 is where the number 70 appears. It says, "And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already." So, in other words, that number is different than the number that we had back here. It said 66, but it gives a qualification for Joseph was in Egypt already. So that's the number of souls that came out of the loins of Jacob. And so we're including Jacob in that for the head of the clan, and then Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh, who were in Egypt. So that adds 4 to the 66. It gives you a total of 70. So in other words, that's a different number. That's not the number who are coming down, but it's the number who are out of the loins, who are in the clan, as it were, who are in that group. And that would include Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh, who are there in Egypt. So I'm not counting the wives now, because the wives of the others weren't counted in this numbering. Now, when you're counting the number of souls that came down, since wives are souls, whether they're of the seed or not, they were considered, human beings. So in some societies they weren't. The point there is that if you add nine wives to the 66 to get a figure for those that came down, then you get a figure of 75. So these numbers are just different numbers because they're talking about a different facet of the group. Okay. Now chapter 46 and verse 28 then. Well, again, verse 27, it says, "And the sons of Joseph, which were born in him in Egypt, were 2 souls. All the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 70. There's your 70 again, just using that same figure, counting Ephraim, Manasseh, and Joseph, and Jacob. Okay, so that does the same thing that Exodus 1:5 does. Verse 28, "And he sent Judah before him unto Joseph to direct his face unto Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen." So Goshen, of course, as I've said before, was a separate area from the Egyptians, even though it was in the nation of Egypt. And so Israel would not be absorbed by intermarriage into Egypt. That was a very important thing, that they'd be living in a land that was somewhat separate. Was there a question here? Yes.
If Goshen was such a good land, how come they weren't in the Egyptians?
Well, that's a good question. it's more than likely has to do with the where their government was set up, where the center of their culture and society was set up, and being real close to the river and so forth as far as commerce and travel and so forth. They had to move up and down the river and so forth in order to govern. That was probably going to be where the population center was. And then, of course, as they were spreading out, another factor, too, is that this territory of Goshen, as good as it was mainly a pastoral area. And since the Egyptians were not too keen on cattle and sheep, as we'll read, that wasn't their area. And so for Israel, this was ideal for them. It was ideal for them, for those who were going to raise cattle and so forth. The Egyptians didn't seem to want to have much to do with that because of religious things. So I think it's probably a combination of those factors. The travel and having the Nile River to move up and down and to keep the empire together, and then the fact that they weren't really interested in the same kinds of things that Israel was interested in. Now, of course, if they had the kind of a population to spread out, of course, they were apparently, just a matter of, there was a lot of land in America, in the early days that they had technically, but they hadn't settled it yet. Just people hadn't got there to get it yet. And I think that's a part of the factor here, too, that they just hadn't expanded to this point yet to populate these areas. That I'm sure would be a very important factor involved. So it was an ideal situation for both the Egyptians and the Israelites at this time. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. They ate the meats and things. They ate the sheep and lambs and so forth that the Egyptians didn't want anything to do with it, that were sacred to them, and part of their gods and so forth. See, the Egyptians, it's just like in India, they have the cows running in the streets and so forth, the proverbial sacred cow and that kind of thing. That's the problem that they had. So I'll get into a little bit more of this. Let's see, probably a little, I don't know if we'll get to it today or not, we might. So I've got some comments on that a little bit later on. All right, so they would be separated. Israel would not be absorbed by intermarriage into Egypt. That's one benefit for them, and that would enable them to pretty much stay as a nation and stay and preserve their own identity. And the wisdom of God is seen here through Joseph. Also, it was the best land for pasturing flocks. Egypt was agriculture. It wasn't that interested in this kind of land, as I mentioned. And Israel would be left alone to grow into a nation and to avoid Egyptian influence of sin and idolatry. So the church also is to grow into a nation while in the world, yet to be separate from it. We are to be, in effect, in the spiritual Goshen. We are to be enjoying the blessings of God and so forth in the land that God has given unto us, but not to become attached to and intermingled with this world system. So we can receive the benefits of Egypt, as it were, but not become entangled in the philosophies of Egypt. As the Apostle Paul said, to use the world, but not overuse it. And don't let it dominate you, but you can use the things that are there. Okay, so we see good typology there. Verses 29 and 30. And the time drew nigh that Israel must die. And he called his son Joseph and said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt. But I will lie with my fathers, and thou shalt carry me out of Egypt, and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. Okay, so Jacob is getting older. He's about to die. And he in effect, is saying, I can now be free to die without regrets and so forth. I've seen my son, and he can die in peace when the time comes. And he's gotten to the point now where he's ready and his heart is ready. Excuse me. Let me check on something here. I think I got up in chapter 47. That's what I did. Okay, my notes aren't matching my. Okay, let's go back 29 and 30. I don't know how that happened. Okay. If you did the same thing I did. Okay, chapter 46, verses 29 and 30. Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, to Goshen, and presented himself unto him. Fell on his neck, wept a good while. Okay. And Israel said unto Joseph, Now let me die, since I have seen thy face, because thou art yet alive. So that makes more sense. It's interesting that that ties in with his actual death. So we just shifted the chapter and had the same thought. Interesting. Okay. Now, it says, Now let me die. It's a little bit strange to say, let me die. But the point is that he can die in peace. Now he's seen what he needed to see. and he feels ready to die without dying with a state of unfulfillment. There's a type in this, Luke chapter 2, verses 29 to 32. This is in the instance where Simeon, who is a type of Jacob and an elder in Israel here, is able to see Jesus being born. And now he feels he can die because he's seen the Messiah. He's seen the hope of Israel. And so in type, Jacob sees Joseph, who is a type of Christ, and now he feels that he can die. Okay, that was Luke 2, 29 to 32. All right, verse 31 to 34 to finish out chapter 46. And Joseph said unto his brethren and unto his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh and say unto him, My brethren and my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, for their trade hath been to feed cattle, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall come to pass when Pharaoh shall call you and say, What is your occupation? That ye shall say, Thy servant's trade hath been about cattle from our youth even until now, both we and all our fathers, that we may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So he tells them to tell him that they're shepherds and they deal with cattle, because he knows that Pharaoh is going to separate him because of that. So they're only telling half of the story to avoid the difficulty. They really were both shepherds and agriculturally minded people. They did, of course, raise crops. But he just says, you just tell them you're shepherds. Don't tell them that you're agricultural as well. Just tell them you're shepherds so that there will be an automatic separation. And because Joseph, you know, senses by the Spirit that it's not best for them to live with the Egyptians and get intermingled and lose the identity and so forth, he wants to keep them separate. The Egyptians did have some cattle, but it was only enough for agricultural purposes and so forth. Ellicott says that the care of cattle probably was left to women and children while the men cultivated the fields. So they took care of enough cattle to be able to pull the plows and that type of thing, but they weren't raising them. Also, the Hebrews' sacrifice of animals and flocks and herds was an abomination to the Egyptians because these animals, as I said before, were sacred to their religion. So they didn't want to have anything to do with that. They didn't have anything to do with that trade. So they weren't raising cattle, even though they used some. Genesis 47, then, verse 1. Then Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, My father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan. And behold, they are in the land of Goshen. So here we see more chance of staying there if they were already there. In other words, he waits till they're already there in Goshen. He tells them, in other words, when you get to Egypt, you just go to Goshen. And then the first time we talk to Pharaoh, we'll say, they're in Goshen now. And in other words, he's just wanting to give more and more impetus to get them settled there. If he tells them they're already there, then it'll be just convenient just to leave them there. So in other words, Joseph's trying to scheme to make sure that they do get Goshen and are able to settle there. Okay, verse 2 to 4. And he took some of his brethren, even five men, and presented them unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto his brethren, What is your occupation? And they said unto Pharaoh, Thy servants are shepherds, both we and all our fathers. They said, Moreover unto Pharaoh, For to sojourn in the land are we come, for thy servants have no pleasure for their flocks. For the famine is sore upon in the land of Canaan. Now therefore we pray thee, let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen. So they're making an appeal as on the basis of shepherds, and the fact that they were shepherds, and so Pharaoh doesn't want them right in Egypt. And this is interesting too in type in one respect. Christ is the great shepherd, and the Egyptians don't want him in Egypt. You know, they want the shepherds out of here, you see. And if we're going to be the shepherds of the sheep, as it were, and take that same trade, the world doesn't like that. The world doesn't even like the concept of shepherding. That speaks too much of submission to authority, things like that. So even today, they're all up in arms against any concept of having human shepherds pastor human sheep. Okay, verses 5 and 6. So Pharaoh spake unto Joseph, saying, Thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee. And the land of Egypt is before thee. In the best of the land make thy father and thy brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell. And if thou knowest any men of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle. So Pharaoh thinks it's his idea now to settle them in the land of Goshen, even though Joseph has been plotting this all along, tells him just what to say and so forth. And it sounds as though Joseph pretty much had the run of Pharaoh here most of the time, and just, you know, planted the right suggestions at the right time, and he followed it. Pharaoh did have cattle too, but for worshiping and plowing and milk and so forth, were sacred animals to worship and that type of thing, but not for sacrificing or for eating as the Israelites did. And so Pharaoh wanted Israel to take care of his cattle as well. All right, verses 7 to 9. And Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto Jacob, how old art thou? And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. Now Jacob was 130 years old at this time, and to Pharaoh he appeared very old. But his days appear few in retrospect is from Jacob's standpoint, because he's comparing them with Abraham, who lived 175, Isaac, who lived 180. So from his perspective, the thing he was measuring them by, they appear to be few in comparison to him. But he said, few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. Evil meaning filled with sufferings and troubles, not meaning that he was a wicked, evil man all this time, although he had his problems. But by evil, he means it was filled with sufferings. There was lots of evil in his life, as it were, lots of catastrophes, lots of problems. And if you stop and look at it and think about it, I'll just list some of the problems that old Jacob went through. First, he deceived his father Isaac, resulting in anxiety and trouble. Then later, Esau sought his life. Then Jacob was forced to flee his home and his servants Laban for 14 years for his wives. He was deceived by Laban many, many times. There was much strife between Leah and Rachel and their maids over the children, and all kinds of deals being going back and forth in order to have children and so forth. His hip was put out of joint when he wrestled with the angel. His entry into Canaan was filled with trouble when his daughter was defiled by Shechem and the cruelty of Simeon and Levi and retribution, and that whole mess that happened. He lost his beloved Rachel when she gave birth to Benjamin. He lost his beloved son Joseph because of the jealousy of his other sons, and he thought he was dead for over 20 years. And now famine had come upon Canaan, and he had to leave the land of his promise. And my response is, and you thought you had troubles, you know. We think about our trials and tests. This man really went through some things all during his life. And one wonders what kind of a life Jacob might have had he not elected the course of deception in order to try to attain the promises. If he'd maintained that attitude and that heart of wanting the blessings of God, but sought them in a different way. But be it so, he certainly would have gone through trials nonetheless, maybe not to the same kind and degree. But this life is not heaven. It's not a bed of roses. There's much pain and suffering and trouble. But we, like Jacob, have Yahweh to go through them with us, just as Jacob did. And God was faithful with Jacob, even though he went through many things. And we'll see him on the other side. We'll see him in glory. And we learn patience and faith and trust and obedience through the trials of life. They perfect us. They remove the dross from our lives. And Jacob had a lot of dross to have removed. So we read in James chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, count it all joy when you fall into diverse trials. It's the plan of God, in effect, because of the curse and because of our sin, to purge us, to cleanse us, to chasten us as dear children, as sons, and wanting us to do it. God wants to see us perfected and set free and brought into that position. So he says, few and evil have been the days of my life, and have not attained unto the days of the years of my life, the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. Verses 10 to 17 then, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. And Joseph placed his father and his brethren and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land of Ramesses, which is the same as the land of Goshen, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph nourished his father and his brethren and all his father's household with bread according to their families. And there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. I think I'll go down to verse 17 first here. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. When the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth. And Joseph said, give your cattle, and I will give you for your cattle if money fail. And they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses and for the flocks and for the cattle of the herds and for the asses, and he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. Okay, Joseph's now taking cattle in payment. Now what's happening here is the famine continues and continues. People are running out of money to buy grain. And the treasure house of Egypt is just loaded. I mean, almost all the money in the world is there now. And Israelites have run out of money, and so he's going to take cattle in payment. Now, this was really a blessing, because it was a burden for them to care for cattle during famine. Nor could they use them, because there was famine and there was no crops and they couldn't use the cattle to do anything with, and they couldn't eat them because of the religion and so forth. And so he says, you can give me cattle and cattle instead. And so at least they couldn't eat them in Egypt there in that area. So the cattle were probably restored after the famine too. After the famine was over, he probably gave them back. And so he's using cattle as payment. And of course, all the Egyptians and so forth, all the people from Canaan and everywhere else were coming to him and giving cattle. Now verses 18 to 20, and when that year was ended, they came unto him a second year and said, the second year, and said to him, we will not hide it from my Lord how that our money is spent. My Lord also hath our herds and cattle of cattle. There is not aught left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our hands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate. And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, and the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them, so the land became Pharaoh's. So this is dealing with all the Egyptians now, and the way Joseph's handling this government. Now it may sound at first glance that Joseph's a real tyrant here, and he's squeezing the last bit of blood out of every turnip, as it were. Now they've sold, given all their money, they've given all their cattle, which they really, you know, was in effect was a blessing in disguise for at least the Egyptians. And now he's going to, they're offering to sell themselves into slavery and give up all their land to Pharaoh for food. Now, it's not what it first appears, because Joseph is not a ruthless tyrant, but he's working to change the sad economic state of Egypt. The people in Egypt were then under many smaller, petty sovereigns who heavily taxed the people. So there was Pharaoh, that was a kind of a head government, but there were lots of little petty kings that were very cruel in general and little tyrants of their in their own right. And the people were under great oppression because of these petty sovereigns. And they were heavily taxed by these sovereigns. So Joseph is working to increase the royal power and bring more unity and strength to the nation. And he's going to use it to bring liberty to the people, because he is of a heart to give the people freedom. So he's in effect getting all of the land under the control of Pharaoh and owned by Pharaoh, as it were. And he's going to break the yoke of and deliver the people from these harsh, petty rulers and save their lives by giving them grain at the same time. And so Joseph is doing the best he can in the interest of the king as the prime minister, and also in the best in the interest of the people. God's giving him wisdom here. And really, a tyrant, a government of an absolute monarchy or a dictator or whatever, is really either the worst kind of government you can have or the best, depending on who the dictator is. If you've got a benevolent, loving dictator who is got all power, but he's using it to help the people and to bless the people, it's the best kind of government you can have. That's what the millennium will be like. But if you've got a tyrant like Hitler or someone like that, or the later pharaohs, you've got the worst kind of government you can have. So it can either be the best or the worst. We settle for democracy because usually we can kind of average it out and get, you know, something we can tolerate. Because we've got enough power in the people to prevent anybody from doing that. But we also suffer in that we can never really get the kind of efficient government we could have. If we had a dictator who was benevolent and so forth, we could get things done a lot quicker. But nobody's willing to take that risk because we don't know who we might get. All right, verse 21, to follow this up. And as for the people, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt even to the other end thereof. So the people are moving to cities because there's no agriculture, so they could be close to the granaries where the food was more easily distributed to them. In other words, they're not able to do anything with the fields now, so it's better to get them in, moved to the city so that they can get the food quickly and so forth. Verse 22, only the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them, for they sold not their lands. So the priests were exempt here. Their land was not bought. It was established by Egyptian law and Pharaoh's commandment, so he couldn't do anything with that. Verse 23, then Joseph said unto the people, behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow the land. So seed for you, that is to sow the land. The famine must be just about over, otherwise it wouldn't be any use to sow the land. And so apparently they're making provision to emerge out of this famine and get ready to have crops and so forth again. So he's giving them seed to sow the land and begin to prepare. Verse 24, and it shall come to pass in the increase that ye shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field, and for your food, and for them of your households, and for food for your little ones. So he's going to set up a new economy, as it were, here. Now that they're going to start having crops, and plant their crops. He's levying a tax, as it were, 1/5 tax, 20% tax to Pharaoh, and then the 80% they could keep for themselves. And this was made a long-standing law. You see down in verse 26, Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day, that Pharaoh would have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's. So they made a law here for a 20% tax. Now that seems high, especially when the Lord only charges 10%, as it were. But it was probably much less than under the vassal lords that they were under before. And the people were in much better and more stable position. And this is less taxes than is normal in the East, in these countries, and so forth. So really, from their perspective, in comparison to other things, it wasn't bad at all. Verse 25, and they said, Thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. So the people were more than happy with his arrangement. They were grateful for their lives. They pledged faithfulness to Pharaoh and his leadership. And spiritually, we see in type again, Jesus has saved our lives, and we become love slaves to God as a result of it. He's bought us, he's purchased us, as it were. He's saved our lives, he's given us our breath and our food. And as a result, we are slaves, but we're happy slaves. We're love slaves. So the people here are happy. They're saved from starvation. They're fed with the bread of life. They're freed from these smaller tyrant underlords. And they've got a benevolent one that's ruling over them, and so they're in much better condition. And they've also got a stable economy beginning to develop, and even with the taxation and so forth, there's going to be a stability now and at least a working economy. And so Christ is saving us from spiritual starvation. He's feeding us with the bread of life. He's freeing us from the smaller petty lords over us, Satan, the demons, religionists, traditions of men. Many of you have been set free from petty these petty kings, as it were, that have ruled over you. And now we're going to be in subjection only to King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and recognize that the land all belongs to him. Okay, verse 26 to 31. And Joseph made it a law, as I said, over the land of Egypt unto this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen. And they had possessions therein, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. And the time drew nigh that Israel must die, and he called his son Joseph, and said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand into my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt. But I will lie with my fathers, and thou shalt carry me out of Egypt, and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. And he said, Swear unto me. And he swore unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. Okay, this is what we read earlier. Now, he said, his thigh, and this now makes more sense. The putting the hand on the thigh. I think we ran across that earlier. And it was a very solemn oath. The thigh, the loins, was a seat of the procreative powers. And so the oath involves the posterity, involves the seed, the offspring, and the promises to the offspring. And of course, that, in the spiritual sense, is containing that promise of the Messiah, the coming of Christ eventually. That's what it's really involving, although they didn't fully understand that. And so he's making an oath and asking for a promise that he be not buried in Egypt, that he be buried in Canaan. And of course, his bones were going to be transported to Canaan when they did leave. It says he bowed himself, probably in worship to God here, to give honor and glory and praise to God and to honor him. Verse chapter 48 then, and we can just begin with this in the time that we have remaining, verses 1 to 3. And it came to pass after these things that one told Joseph, Behold, thy father is sick. And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And one told Jacob and said, Behold, thy son Joseph cometh unto thee. And Israel strengthened himself and sat upon the bed. And Jacob said unto Joseph, God Almighty appeared unto me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. Okay, he's about to die. He's getting sick and he's about to die. He's made this promise. Joseph's made this promise to him and so forth. And he, at his death, he's going to be conferring blessings upon his sons. And first here we see Ephraim and Manasseh brought in and Joseph. And he refers back to El Shaddai again. That God Almighty, El Shaddai, appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. Of course, Bethel was the name that it was changed to. This is those appearances in Bethel that he's referring to. And so he says in verses 4 and 5, after that introduction, he said unto me, Behold, I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee, and will make of thee a multitude of people, and will give this land to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession. And now thy two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born unto thee in the land of Egypt before I came unto thee in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. So he says that they're his sons. He's formally adopting them, as it were. He's adopting them as into his family, though, as though they were his own sons. And this is interesting because Reuben and Simeon were actually the firstborn. He says, as Reuben and Simeon, Reuben was the firstborn and Simeon was the second. And what's happening here is that Ephraim and Manasseh are in effect going to take the positions that Reuben and Simeon had had. Though they were grandsons to Jacob, they were Joseph's sons, and they were each going to get an inheritance in Israel, and they're going to become tribes. So when we look at the maps of the land of Israel at the time of the kingdom, and the various tribes, or before the kingdom, when they were divided into the tribes, we find that there's no tribe of Joseph represented. But there is a tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh. And of course, those two together form Joseph. They were Joseph's two sons. And the point is that Joseph is going to get a double portion of the inheritance, one for each of his sons. And the birthright, in effect, is being given to Joseph. And so he's the first one that he's going to confer blessings on here and upon his sons. And because Reuben had defiled his father's concubine, it's told us, 1 Chronicles 5, verses 1 and 2, it's not really told us for sure until there why this happened. But 1 Chronicles 5, verses 1 and 2 gives us the reason that Reuben was not given the firstborn portion is because he defiled his father's concubine. And then the act of his defiling his father's concubine is recorded in Genesis 35:22. We did read that already. Genesis 35:22. So Joseph would receive a double portion, one to Ephraim, one to Manasseh. And Joseph became two tribes. And so we have a total of 13 tribes of this new nation of Israel. But Levi was to become the priests, and they were to have no earthly inheritance. So as far as the parcels of land were concerned, there were still 12. You have Ephraim and Manasseh, that adds one, but then Levi subtracts one as far as the inheritances were concerned. Now, Ephraim and Manasseh were probably in their early 20s at this time that the blessings are being conferred on them. And so verse 6, and thy issue which thou begettest after them shall be thine, and shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance. So in other words, any sons that Joseph might have in addition to Ephraim and Manasseh would be his own, and Ephraim and Manasseh are adopted to Jacob now, and would be included in the tribe names of Ephraim and Manasseh. But there's no mention of any other sons that Joseph had in Scripture, so apparently that never really was a factor. Yes, Rob? Well, I don't know if Simeon's really being put down a step in a sense, because it was really only the firstborn that gets that double portion, and Simeon wouldn't have gotten the double portion anyway, he was second. But to mention, what he's doing is to draw a parallel. These two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, are going to be in effect like the first two. In other words, they're going to be in that position. And of course, as we'll see, that it's Ephraim that gets the firstborn portion between those two. And so Manasseh is more like Simeon and so forth. There's a certain honor there, but he's just saying they're going to be just like my first two. And the firstborn one, of course, is the one that gets the blessing. So I think that's probably what he's alluding to. And, of course, Simeon, of course, had not pleased him too much either. So he was kind of in a rough position. All right, we'll stop there and continue next week.